Hey, good morning, members. So today we have a full day of presentations from the Department of Human Services. The first presentation, we're going to learn about NEMT, non-emergency medical transport. And this item is important because it's a change in how we've been doing things in NEMT. The governor has proposed moving to a uniform administration of NEMT, and this would reduce general fund expenditures by $80 million over the biennium. So we're going to learn about that proposal and have time for questions. And then the second overview is going to be on the legacy information technology systems used by DHS in our counties. So we're going to start by taking the roll call. So if you want to unmute yourself, please proceed, Ms. Hansen.
Good morning, everyone. Chair Schultz.
Present.
Vice Chair Bonner.
Present.
Representative Albright?
Good morning, and Albright is here.
Thank you, sir. Representative Bolden?
Present.
Representative Burkle?
Present.
Representative Fisher?
Fisher, present.
Representative Frederick?
Present.
Representative Hansen?
Present.
Representative Keel?
Here.
Thank you. Representative Liebling?
Present.
Representative Mueller?
Present.
Representative Knorr? Representative Novotny?
Novotny, St. Paul, present.
Thank you. Representative Pearson?
Pearson, present.
Thanks. Representative Pinto?
Present.
Representative Rasmussen?
Present.
Representative Robbins?
Present.
Thank you. Representative Sandel?
Present.
Representative Schumacher?
Schumacher, present.
Thank you, members.
Thank you, Ms. Hansen. We have a quorum, but I first got ahead of myself. I need to call this committee hearing of Human Services, Finance, and Policy to order. Okay, the next item are the minutes. Representative Sandel, would you like to move the minutes from February 9th?
Madam Chair, I have read the minutes, and I move that they, I make a motion that they be adopted.
Okay, motion to approve the minutes from February 9th. Sounds like Representative Sandel's dog also is making that motion with us. Any discussion or corrections to the minutes? Hearing none, please unmute yourself. So Representative Sandel moves approval of the minutes for February 9th, 2021. All those in favor say aye.
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 Aye. Any opposed? Motion prevails and the minutes are adopted. So members, like I said previously, we're going to first learn about NEMT, and we have with us Assistant Commissioner Matt Anderson. He's the Assistant Commissioner for Healthcare and State. He's the State Medicaid Director at DHS. So Assistant Commissioner Anderson, welcome to the committee, and please proceed with your overview.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, committee members. Appreciate being with you this morning. For the record, my name is Matt Anderson. As the chair indicated, I'm Assistant Commissioner for Healthcare and State Medicaid Director at the Minnesota Department of Human Services. My colleague, Matt Burdick, is going to pull up a few slides and encourage and look forward to your questions about non-emergency medical transportation or NEMT. Next slide, please. The Minnesota Care and Medical Assistance or Medicaid programs provide coverage for non-emergency medical transportation for definition purposes. This is transportation that our enrollees need to get to a medically necessary covered service. And we cover the most appropriate mode of transportation for that individual at the least costly way of getting them to where they need to be. Again, this is covered in our medical assistance or Medicaid program. It's also covered in Minnesota Care for individuals under age 19. As a general rule, transportation is provided for up to 30 miles for primary care, 60 miles for specialty care, unless the enrollee has authorization for a longer distance because of medical needs. Next slide. When we talk about non-emergency medical transportation, we're actually talking about an array of different modes of transportation, and these are all based on the transportation that a particular enrollee will receive will be based on what his or her individual needs are. So clients are offered, as I said before, the least costly, most appropriate mode of transportation. And that begins with mode one on the slide here. And that is based on an assessment of their physical and cognitive ability and access to whether or not they have a personal vehicle or access to other transit. And then we move up the options until the most appropriate transportation is found for the individual. Just as a note here, some of these are fairly self-explanatory, but just want to note that unassisted, mode three, if you think of a taxi cab-like experience, this is where a vehicle picks the person up, usually at their curb, drops them back off at the curb. The individual has the mental and or cognitive and physical capability to get in and out of the vehicle, get to the vehicle themselves, that kind of thing. It also includes public transportation. Assisted, level four, mode four, provides assistance for individuals who need help because of cognitive or physical limitations, such as going to the door and helping the person get to the vehicle and into the vehicle. The driver would also go with the person into the facility to make sure that they get to where they need to be for whatever appointment they have. Protected transport, mode six, is the newest mode of transportation that we cover, and it's been used very rarely, but it's meant to allow for non-emergency medical transportation for individuals who are experiencing a mental health crisis. And it's really intended to be an alternative to a transport, usually by law enforcement, and sometimes involving law enforcement can actually exacerbate the mental health crisis. And so this was designed as a way to be able to provide a different mode of transportation that may be better for the enrollee in the crisis that they're having. Next slide. Although not technically part of the non-emergency medical transportation benefit, but these are benefits that are administered jointly, is reimbursement for parking, lodging, or meals. This benefit is only allowed in certain situations. If a person has to be gone for a very long period of time, they may be eligible for meal reimbursement. The cost of lodging, for example, we have to be able to demonstrate that the cost for a hotel stay is going to be less than what it would cost for the transport to go back and forth in the same day, but wanted to note those as additional ways that we help our enrollees make sure that they can get to the appointments that they need to be able to manage their health. Next slide. So in today's world, our administration of these benefits is broken into several different pieces. First, we have managed care. Our managed care contracts cover about 75% of our enrollees in total. The non-emergency medical transportation benefit is part of the managed care contract, and so it's administered by the health plans for their enrolled members. The exception to this is, again, that personal mileage in mode one, as well as meals, parking, and lodging, because those are reimbursements directly to the enrollee. Managed care organizations are not allowed under law to make payments directly to enrollees. And so those payments, when they're involved, those are the counties manage those payments for those benefits for managed care enrollees. On the fee-for-service side, the other 25% of the enrollees that we insure, administration of our non-emergency transportation is split into two categories. Counties administer modes one through four. They enroll and pay providers to deliver the service. They conduct the assessment to determine which mode of transportation is most appropriate for that individual. And the state, likewise, for modes five through seven, we administer those benefits, we enroll and pay the providers, and we have a vendor who performs the level of need determinations to assess what the person is most eligible for. Next slide. So as Chair Schultz referenced, as part of Governor Walz's proposed budget, we are recommending changes to how we administer our non-emergency medical transportation benefits for both the medical assistants and that Minnesota Care enrollees under age 19. This would change administration across our fee-for-service and managed care populations. And really what it would do is consolidate all of the NEMT benefits into a uniform administrator that we would contract with that one entity would then manage either on a statewide or a regional basis the medical transportation, non-emergency medical transportation benefits for our enrollees. Part of this is driven, or part of the reason for this proposal was driven by a 2017 audit by the Federal Office of Inspector General that audited our non-emergency medical transportation services. That audit found that 75% of rides that it reviewed did not comply with either state or federal requirements, either because they didn't have sufficient documentation, they didn't have any documentation, or the auditor could not find a corresponding medical service that warranted the trip in the first place. So as a result of that, DHS returned $1.9 million to the federal government. A similar audit performed by our Minnesota Office of Inspector General within DHS found very similar results. This audit also showed that having a coordinator in place administering the program increased the likelihood that transport was provided appropriately and that payments were made appropriately. So this proposal would really streamline the administration of our non-emergency medical transportation on two fronts. First, it would allow for economies of scale in administering the program because you'd have a single administrator that would be administering all of the rides. And second, that for some members in our current administration configuration find it difficult to navigate as to who they're supposed to call for which rides or who's doing the assessments. This would create a one-call experience for our NEMT needs. So an enrollees who need transportation to an appointment would have one place they would call, and that one place would be able to administer all of those benefits. Now, clearly, as we look across the country, NEMT benefits are administered in a lot of different ways in a lot of different states. This is an area where states are continuing to try to figure out the best ways to manage this benefit and to be able to make sure that their enrollees have access to care. So we understand that this is one method of administering the program, and it's one that the Blue Ribbon Commission had examined as one of its strategies. It does save money in the program, and that was one of the objectives of the Blue Ribbon Commission, but it's certainly not the only way to administer a program. Next slide. I'd also like to take just a moment to talk about another proposal in the governor's budget that we want to highlight because it's also related to non-emergency medical transportation. And this is to provide enrollees in certain communities with access to public transit. Currently, an enrollee who is, again, as their assessment based on cognitive and physical abilities, is able to use public transportation to get to medical appointments, they can get essentially a bus pass or a transit pass in today's world if they have enough individual rides where the cost of that monthly pass is equal to or less than what it would cost the state to pay for all of the rides on an individual basis. What this proposal does is it removes that cost effectiveness test, and it basically says that if a member qualifies for one trip on public transportation, they could receive a monthly pass and be able to use that. This is really intended as a way of trying to get at social determinants of health. Transportation for our enrollees is one of the biggest barriers, not only to healthcare, but also to getting healthy food, to getting to employment or childcare and other aspects of their life. So by being able to provide this, we would be increasing their quality of life and also increasing those social determinants that produce better health outcomes. I want to emphasize for clarity purposes, this is not precluding anybody from the other modes of transportation that we cover through non-emergency medical transportation. And it's not forcing anybody to accept public transportation or a monthly bus pass if they're not well served by public transportation. And that could be because of their cognitive or physical abilities. It's not appropriate for them to be using that mode of transportation. They don't live in a community that's served well by public transportation, or the particular appointment that they have, that clinic isn't on a bus route or isn't easily accessible to public transportation. It wouldn't require them to use it in that. So we believe that this is an innovative proposal to try to get at ways that we can address those social determinants of health that impact our enrollees and their quality of life. Thank you very much for your attention. Madam Chair, if there are questions, we'd be happy to address those.
Yes, I do have a couple questions, Assistant Commissioner. So my first question is, my understanding that this will be paid on a per member per month or capitated payment to this administrator. And I'm just wondering how that rate will be set and if that leads to any perverse incentives by the person doing the transport not wanting to go long distances or in more rural areas, greater distances, how will that rate be set? So I'm just worried that we might be creating some barriers for people to get access to transportation.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Those are all legitimate concerns and questions. So you're correct that this would be on a per member per month basis. So a capitated-like arrangement with the administrator that would create incentives for the administrator to make sure that there is appropriate documentation, that services are being used when there's a medically necessary appointment that the person needs to get to, basically dealing with some of those compliance issues that we've had in recent audits. In addition, as you talk about different areas of the state having different needs, the rate process would have to take those factors into account. And so you can see where if we were administering this on a regional basis, there may be different capitated rates in different regions of the state to be able to deal with issues of length of transports, availability of public transportation, which can significantly affect the cost of this benefit in different communities. And then also having some oversight around the ability to make sure that people that are getting to appointments where they have to go a much longer distance because of a specialty appointment or something like that, that those are being approved and authorized appropriately.
Thank you for that. And has that rate framework, the formula used to set the per member per month rate, has that been finalized yet?
Madam Chair, no, that hasn't been developed at all. That would be something that would be that we would have to go through past cost experience and utilization and develop those rates if this legislation passes.
Okay, thank you. We're going to move to Representative Moeller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Anderson, I had a question related to Metro Mobility, which I know isn't under the purview of your agency, and I know there are different requirements for eligibility and it's limited to a certain area within our state. But I'm just wondering if how there's overlap and what your work is with Metro Mobility.
Commissioner?
Madam Chair, Representative Moeller, thank you for the question. Metro Mobility is paid as part of our NEMT benefit. It is considered public transportation. And so that would be as we look at particularly the governor's proposal around continuous access to public transportation, this would be a way of being able to coordinate that and make that more seamless for those enrollees that are using Metro Mobility. But generally speaking, in the overall, as we talk about a single administrator in that proposal, it would just be part of our public transit and would be one of the modalities that under the assessment that people would be the assessor would determine whether or not that was appropriate and safe mode of transportation for those enrollees.
Representative Moeller. Representative Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In my area, Northwestern Minnesota, we have maybe one provider, or they have to come from a long ways away to help get people to dialysis three times a week or whatever, and the distance is huge. We're not talking about a short trip at all. And so I'm a little concerned about how you would administer this area and how big it would be and how we would deal with the private entities that now do provide a service that we don't have any other way. We don't have a Metro Mobility or anything that would even get slightly close to getting people to those appointments. I myself have ridden in a vehicle because the loved one I was taking, I could not transport in my own vehicle. So I went with, And that was how we got her to the doctor we needed to go to. How are you dealing with that area that would be so large?
Assistant Commissioner?
Madam Chair, Representative Keel, those rural areas really do have significant challenges when it comes to non-emergency medical transportation, not only by distance, but also by available providers and being able to ensure that we have access. What I would say is that in today's world, that provider is dealing with managed care organizations that have their own individual contracts with that individual provider. It's dealing with the county in some of the services that it's providing. It probably isn't dealing with the state because we have the higher modalities and service needs, but it may be. One of the advantages for some providers will be that again, they would only have to be dealing with one administrator, and that one administrator is going to have to be able to demonstrate that they have the provider network to be able to meet the needs of enrollees within that community. And so that would be part of the contract requirements, just as we do with managed care organizations today around making sure that they have sufficient providers to provide for the medical services of enrollees, and that in some areas they're going to have to make adjustments to be able to deal with geographic access because of the large distances that they're going to have to go. And so that would have to be part of that administrator's responsibility, is making sure that they have those contracts in place with providers to be able to deliver those services.
Representative Keel?
I got other questions, but let's move on.
Okay, thank you. Representative Bonner.
Thank you. And I will apologize in case I missed this already, and I think I know the answer, but it's always good to verify. So I know some of our suburban communities do have specific services like Maple Grove Transit, for example, and I know we offer something called My Ride up here in Maple Grove and surrounding community. And I'm just curious how that interfaces with this program. Do they partner with those programs, or how does that interplay work?
Assistant Commissioner Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Bonner. I'm not familiar with that program specifically, so my answer is going to be more broad than that. But again, as we look at our current NEMT benefits and which modality a person is appropriate for, that public transportation option is one of the modalities that we will look at. And if that service has its routes are near the patient's home and near the clinic that they need to go to, and it's, again, appropriate for them on a cognitive and physical basis, that would be one of the ways that we would allow them to be able to use that service. Those that have higher needs, higher modalities, so I think the MyRide service is really around ADA accessible transport for individuals. That might be one of those higher modes where someone is going to need assisted or wheelchair assisted services. That would be one of the options that they would have available to them. Likewise, under the proposal to provide a monthly pass for individuals, again, if that's the mode of transportation that would be available to them and they can get a monthly pass, that would be one of the ways that they would be able to benefit from that service.
Representative Bonner, do you have a follow-up?
I do. And I think that's good. And maybe we can take this offline because it's a little bit more specific. But I'd love to follow up on, how those two might work together or partner together, because I do know that it's a valuable service in our community. And I'd love to, not be stepping on each other's toes and make sure that we're working together as partners.
Thank you, Representative Bonner. So Assistant Commissioner, do counties have flexibility if this is implemented in changing the type of service that they need? For example, during COVID, I know many of them had to make sure they were texting the client or calling the client to confirm appointments or to note their arrival. Will there still be flexibility that counties have under a uniform administrator?
Madam Chair, so under the uniform administrator, the counties would have much less of a role in having to deal with that administration at the beginning. So the administrator would be the one that would be setting up text or call confirmations to make sure that the person is that their appointment is still on. They aren't doing it by telemedicine. They actually do need a transport, all of those kinds of activities. So this would reduce the burden on counties to have to fulfill those activities.
And so would there be a discussion with counties about the guidelines for the NEMT providers, saying that, you know, you're going to have to have this guidance, this policy of texting and contacting the client, and that would be uniform across all the providers in under one contract?
Correct. So that would be, as you think of it, the requirements that we would impose on the administrator. Here's what we're going to require you to have in place, or that your providers have in place. That administrator then would, when contracting with providers, would want to make sure that contract includes those requirements, that they're going to follow that, and that they're going to document that so that the payments are appropriate, and that we can, if we have another audit, that we can document that those payments were made in accordance with the requirements that were in place.
Okay, thank you. Representative Liebling.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. So I have a number of questions about this, and I won't ask all of them because I know this is going to have a lot more discussion. But I was glad that Chair Schultz asked a little bit more about the counties. I'm a little unclear of what the county role. Well, let me just kind of lay out the things, and then we'll see if any of them can be answered quickly here. So one is about what the county role, what role they retain under this proposal. Another one is a little concern of mine that I know has been a concern in the past when these kinds of proposals were considered, is that there are a lot of small providers of NEMT services in a lot of different communities. And when we have a central administrator, and even under current system, actually, there's sometimes disputes about who gets a contract. And this is especially important for some minority communities, where there are culturally sensitive or people from that community who want to participate in providing rides. So there's that whole issue. We probably don't want to touch that too much today, but the other one that I maybe would like to get an answer on is if you've given thought to, as this gets priced out, as the costs of this are changing, whether we're going to get any savings in the proposal from increased use of telemedicine. So I assume that there's a lot of interaction here, and probably the biggest savings to the state will come back in the form of those people who are able to have their visit without actually getting any transportation, especially like what Representative Keel was talking about. Now, obviously this does not apply to everybody at all, but certainly there will be many visits where a person can do it from the convenience of their home or a close location and not need that expensive long ride. So I just a little bit on whether you're trying to price that in would be great. Thank you.
Assistant Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Chair Liebling, thank you for the questions. I'm going to try to go through those in order, but please let me know if I forget one. First, in terms of the role of the counties, again, because we would be moving to a single administrator model, the counties would be taken off the functions that they currently play in the system. They would no longer be managing or administering the benefits or the assessments or any of those functions that they currently play today. So that would be moved to the administrator, and the county's role would be to focus on the county related activities that they already have on their plate without having non-emergency medical transportation as part of that. The second question around culturally specific transportation and who gets contracts. Again, that would be the administrator would be setting up those contracts and arranging for those. Again, the administrator's incentives are going to be to make sure that there are transportation services available, that the enrollees feel comfortable with those transportation services and are able to get to the appointments they need. And so there would be an incentive for them to make sure that there's culturally appropriate services for members who speak a different language or have different cultural needs to be able to address those. And then third, the savings from telemedicine. So there's a telemedicine proposal that's also the Governor Walz is also putting forward. We do not, as we are trying to develop the estimates of fiscal ramifications of different proposals, we generally don't combine them because one may pass and one may not. So when we do the non-emergency medical transportation proposal, we are doing the fiscal estimates around that based on this proposal, if implemented, given our historical utilization and costs and spending, the telemedicine changes, if those were to be made and implemented, that would obviously have a significant impact in non-emergency medical transportation utilization, as you indicated, but that's not factored into our estimates at this stage.
Okay, Representative Lavely.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thanks for that. Good job zipping through a lot of complex stuff, and I look forward to continuing the conversation. Thank you.
Absolutely, thank you.
Okay, it looks like you have, do you have someone with you, Assistant Commissioner from DHS, or is that just for questions?
We have several of my colleagues from DHS here who are here to help me with questions. If you give me a stumper, if I need to phone a friend.
Okay, it sounds good. I just want to make sure we were done with the presentation. We do have testifiers today. So we'll go to the first testifier, Buck McAlpin.
Madam Chair, members, thanks. Yeah.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and tell us your affiliation, please.
Buck McAlpin, I'm here today representing the Minnesota Ambulance Association and the Minnesota R80. It's a rural alliance of about 600 wheelchair van companies throughout the rural 80 counties. The Ambulance Association's concern with this, obviously, is North Memorial, Alina, and MHealth Fairview have large NEMT companies in the metro. And we've kind of been through this administrative conversation for a while, to Representative Liebling's point. But a little step back in history, Assistant Commissioner Anderson referred to the audit. That was looking at transportation that took place back in 2012 and 2013. After that, the state legislature, some of you that are still in this committee today, led by Representative Kim Norton and Senator Kathy Sharon over in the Senate, spent nearly, I believe, $8 million to make major changes and implement into 256B lots of changes around documentation, trip verification. And the piece in there that's interesting, which is still has not taken place today, is it directed the Commissioner of Human Services to develop and implement a one-year pilot project of a single administrative structure, not to go hire an administrator, but for the state to develop a system to do that. To this day, that's never taken place. We've tried the administrator model. The state's tried it before and it's failed. Blue Cross and Blue Shield have tried two administrators. To Representative Keel points, it's failed. And one of the questions about the contracting, this is a drive to the bottom, this model. The only way the administrator really makes money is to not pay providers. And that's been our experience way back into 2004 when we've had these conversations. It destroyed hospital throughput and flow, and how hospitals just pick up the phone and call their providers today and discharge patients. When you put a middleman in that conversation, that continues to stop. The other interesting piece, Representative Liebling's right, and I think Representative Schultz, Madam Chair, you brought up COVID. Most of rural providers especially are all losing money this year. If it wouldn't be for the help of the health plans, the managed care plans, and taking them out of this conversation, they have all increased rates to rural providers. And I have a chart right in front of me that as we testify further on down the road more about the financial side of this bill, they're about 47% down on their Medicaid fee-for-service. They attribute that to telehealth. We're currently seeing a 25% reduction in ambulance volume still across the state, as we talked about a few weeks ago in Chairwoman Liebling's committee on ambulance issues. And we figure it's close to $80, $85 million for ambulance and non-emergency that's out of the system financially. So that more than covers what the state is trying to accomplish in this budget with the Blue Ribbon Task Force. So I would just caution that we've been down this road. The industry is very fragile right now. We have providers that have closed in non-emergency. After 5 o'clock at night, you can't get a wheelchair van in rural Minnesota, so ambulances are doing it, and maybe the only ambulance covering a 100-mile 911 service area. But taking managed care out of it is a big impact because they're the only ones that have stepped up and kept the infrastructure afloat over the last year of the COVID saga. So we look forward to working with everybody as this moves forward to really talk about the reality of using an administrator at this level to manage these programs.
Thank you, Mr. McAlpin. It looks like Representative Liebling may have a question for you. Go ahead, Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. McAlpin. And, you know, you had quite a few things in there. First of all, if you've written anything up on that, I think it would be helpful to us to make sure that we get all the various pieces. But I just wanted to make a comment. You know, when you say that the managed care has increased rates, the legislature has no way of knowing that. And we have no way of knowing how much that's increased, what it's covered, who's getting increases, or any of that. So I just want to point that out once again. You know, we can say that about managed care, and we, the legislature, have no, I don't know what data you got, but we don't have it. So just wanted to point that out once again.
Thank you, Representative Liebling. Our second testifier is Joel Euland from UCARE. Please introduce yourself to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Joel Euland. I'm the Associate Vice President of Public Affairs for UCARE. UCARE is a health plan serving more than 500,000 members in Minnesota, and I'm also here today on behalf of the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. Thank you for the opportunity to discuss the non-emergency medical transportation program. Currently, the Minnesota nonprofit health plans under contract with DHS coordinate rides for our members. Each plan may do it just a bit differently based on the needs and the demographics of the members that we serve. Health plans put great emphasis on coordinating the overall needs of our members, especially members with complex needs. There are many examples of health plan care coordinators working with our seniors and people with disabilities to develop care plans for medical appointments and therapy visits into the future, and then at the same time coordinating the transportation for those visits. The council opposes having transportation handled by a single state-run administrator. We have established a robust transportation networks and utilize flexible alternative modes such as bus passes and volunteer drivers when feasible. We are nimble and we are able to respond to and rapidly address the needs of our members and partners. This flexibility was particularly evident in Greater Minnesota during the early stages of COVID-19. Health plans work closely with our transportation providers in those areas to address the unanticipated fluctuations in demand and help sustain our providers and the availability of services at a crucial time for our members. Last summer, after the civil unrest, health plans stepped up to provide rides to grocery stores and pharmacies when members suddenly found themselves in a food or pharmacy desert in their own local community. Managed care contracts provide the state with budget predictability and stability. The council would appreciate additional detail and fiscal notes supporting the estimated cost savings of the DHS proposal. We also want to understand if the proposed savings take into account the impact of the health plan payment delays and payment withholds that are part of our contracts as well. There should also be a thorough examination of the state's experience with managing this program with Medicaid fee-for-service. In particular, we note that the referenced federal OIG report only examined fee-for-service claims, many of which were found to be out of compliance. We look forward to continuing the conversation as the committee continues to review this proposal, and I'd be happy to take any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Euland. If you can send me your written testimony, that would be helpful.
Certainly, I can do that.
Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Madam Chair, I will apologize that there may be some of that history from those previous years and some of the work that was done to make recommendations and, of course, bring up compliance and make sure that we have proper documentation so money is being spent wisely and so forth. But the one thing that I'm struggling with a little bit in this conversation is, you know, obviously we are very grateful to the providers who are actually providing this service, right? And that is not a dispute. But, you know, I always look through the lens of how are we best serving people? How are we being consistent? How are we making it as accessible as possible to use these programs and to do so efficiently and effectively? I think that tends to save money, but it also means that we're serving our ultimate customer, the citizens of Minnesota. And so I guess the one thing I hope does not get lost in this conversation is the idea that having consistency about how we access these services, how citizens can actually have a point of contact that follows the same process and procedure, that it's similar no matter what service, no matter what area of the state you live in. I think those process innovations are something that are really important. And I hope we don't lose sight of that because it really does matter for everyday citizens.
Thank you, Representative Bonner. Okay, I'm not seeing any other questions from members. Assistant Commissioner, would you like to respond to any of the questions or comments that were made by the testifiers?
Thank you, Madam Chair. The only thing I would note is that we are in the process now of doing a similar audit of non-emergency medical transportation and continuing to see issues around documentation or lack of documentation. And so just want to, while there's reference to the audits that have occurred in the past, we still have challenges in that area.
Okay, well, we appreciate this overview, and I'm sure we will have many more questions for you about this, and we'll hear those when we hear pieces of the governor's budget proposal. Okay, moving on to our next agenda item, we're going to learn about the legacy IT systems that the Department of Human Services uses and that are used by our counties, for example, MET system. I think we spend hundreds of millions of dollars maintaining these systems, and they're used from everything to check eligibility to compliance and to payments. So the first presenter is Chuck Johnson, our Deputy Commissioner from DHS. Welcome, Commissioner Johnson. Please introduce yourself to the committee and proceed with your overview.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Chuck Johnson. I serve as Deputy Commissioner for Operations at the Department of Human Services, and thanks for the opportunity to be here. I think Matt is going to put some slides up for us to view. Go to the next slide. I really appreciate the opportunity here today to present on our IT systems here in Minnesota and the work that we're doing to try to move forward with our IT infrastructure. Like all states, Minnesota is highly dependent. Our human service system is highly dependent on IT systems and has been for decades. And of course, in Minnesota, with a state supervised county administered system, the counties are also very dependent on those systems to carry out the services at the local level, as are many of our tribal partners who work with us in service delivery. The hardest part for us has been moving not just transformation for IT, but also transformation of how we deliver human services. That's also dependent on our IT systems. Where we want to move toward is a system with no wrong door access, where people can apply, update, communicate online through mobile, can share documents with us, can really manage their own cases and their own experience in human services without having to come into a county office. We actually operate a system now that I sometimes call almost 19th century. A lot of the services, the way they're delivered are, you have to come into a county and fill out a lot of forms. And we have moved forward in a few areas to improve that. We have a lot of work to do. And also integrating data to support the delivery of services and outcomes. And this is important not just to be able to make reports, but also to be able to understand who people are and what their needs are, and to really be able to meet individual needs and not simply use data as a way to manage reporting and administrative functions. Next slide. The driving factors around IT transformation and modernization, as I said, is moving toward a person-centered human services delivery system. We have outdated, antiquated systems that are based on old technologies, different technologies that don't always integrate and work together very well. Some of this you see, for example, when you put forward a new initiative and we say it's going to take us a year to get it done because of the complexity of our IT systems and the inflexibility of some of the older systems and the difficulty of making changes. We're also in a position of several of our systems of losing key staff who have been working on these systems for years, have knowledge of how they work, expertise that can walk out the door. And so we need to be working for that issue as well. We also look at compliance with state and federal requirements, being able to make changes to be compliant, being able to keep up with changes as they're coming at us. And also in our direct care and treatment, providing safe treatment services in secure settings, ensuring that we have the proper infrastructure to support those services. Next slide. So I'm going to go through the what we call our major systems. We have 375 applications in the Department of Human Services. I'm going to talk about, I think, seven of them that are the biggest ones that really manage most of the services within the agency. But I want you to know there's a lot of other applications within the department. Listed here are some of the key functions that those systems carry out for us: eligibility, program enrollment determination, assessments, that category, ensuring program integrity and compliance, managing client data, provider data, and paying for services, which is a big part of what we do through our infrastructure as well. 31,000 county, tribal, and state workers, 450,000 healthcare providers, 1.7 million clients. The numbers are really large in terms of the services that we're providing and all the people that are involved somehow in making those services happen. And then we have direct care and treatment, which, while smaller with only 13,000 patients and clients, is a 24/7 health system operation and has its own complexity. As you said at the outset, Madam Chair, we spend over $200 million a year to support this IT infrastructure and around the edges, as I'll talk about later, to make improvements in the IT infrastructure going forward. Next slide. These are the seven what we think of as our major systems, systems that I'm going to talk about today, and I'll run through each of them and provide you some background on them. There's information on the slides, and certainly we can get deeper into anything someone would be interested in. You'll see here again these functions: case management, eligibility, claims payment structure, that's essentially what we're doing with these systems. So let's start with MMIS, our Medicaid Management Information System. This is the claims payment system. That's how we sort of label it for DHS. Actually does a lot more than that. But this is one of our older systems, 1994. I think 1994 was actually what we called MMIS-2, and there was its history goes back into the 80s, I believe, the actual origins of the system. It is a mainframe system built on COBOL. I'll talk about the first three systems I'm going to talk about are all mainframe. What you get with mainframe is they're very fast, they're very stable, they can process a lot of information, do a lot of transactions, but they're not very flexible. And that's been our challenge with these systems. But again, on the right-hand side, you can see the volume that we're working through with a system of claims system of this size. 87 million claims paid annually, 28 million capitation payments paid to the managed care organizations, $12 billion a large volume of business, including a lot of state and federal funding that runs through this system. Next slide. This is MAXIS, which is our older eligibility system. MAXIS supports the cash programs, cash assistance, and SNAP, as well as a portion of healthcare for seniors and people with disabilities. Again, an older system, mainframe system, built on database natural code. And again, a large volume, processing 2.5 million online transactions per day, sends over 230,000 notifications each month, and issues benefits under our cash and food programs, again, for over a million Minnesotans who receive these services. Again, this is a system that counties are very involved in using on a daily basis for doing eligibility across all of our cash and food programs, part of Medicaid, as well as a 4E foster care. PRISM is the system that supports our child support program. Again, it's a mainframe system. Again, you can see large processing numbers on the right-hand side of this slide. PRISM process essentially handles all of the functions within child support, from enforcement, parent locating services, as well as the transactional and financial pieces, $550 million a year. We have a payment center that processes over 200,000 payments per month of child support payments. And so again, this is child support workers in counties and tribes use this system on a regular basis to manage the child support program. We built a few improvements around it, including a portal for clients to come in and be able to manage their own cases and look at their own cases. So we continue to make some advancements, but the underlying system is an older, less flexible mainframe system. Social services information system, I would think of as largely being our case management system. This is where counties use for managing cases within more of our social services operations. It was originally developed for child welfare, child protection, foster care, adoption, those functions. It still supports those programs, but has been expanded over time to include children's mental health, as well as adult programs, maltreatment reporting, and waiver claiming. We've also developed over time to handle more of the fiscal functions that counties have, including this is the system counties use to draw down federal dollars for services that they provide directly, that they're eligible for federal reimbursement. And again, fairly large numbers of processing going on here within this system. Next is my avatar. This is the electronic medical record that is used by our direct care and treatment. Direct care and treatment is the part of the agency, most of our employees, although a relatively small part of our budget, that provides services across over 100 locations in the state, over 5,000 employees, and about 12,000, 13,000 active clients and patients. The programs are listed on the right. This is our St. Peter Forensics Program, Security Hospital, Sex Offender Program, AMRTC in Anoka, and all the other ancillary services that we run. This particular product is operated by or owned by NetSmart, and it specializes in behavioral health medical record support. So it includes our assessments, treatment plans, medications, billing, coding, and collections, and those aspects of medical record. MEC Squared, the Minnesota Electronic Child Care, supports Child Care Assistance Program. It determines eligibility, enrollment, authorizations for child care, which is a fairly complex function within the child care program. And also makes the payments to providers. It does include a portal for providers to be able to submit their bills monthly, so there's a direct provider access. It's a little bit newer system, but it's integrated into Maxis, and a lot of the back-end functions are within Maxis, which is the older eligibility system. And again, you can see on the right-hand side the volumes that are handled by this system within our child care assistance program. And finally, METS. METS is used for eligibility for most of the people in healthcare, not for the seniors and people with disabilities, but for most of the families with kids and adults without children. It's an eligibility and enrollment system. It also supports MNsure for the private market eligibility for advanced premium tax credits, integrated with Get Insured, which is the enrollment record that MNsure runs, and integrated with MMIS, which is our enrollment system and system of record. Over a million accounts. This is a system in which clients can have their own account and do their own application and management, as well as caseworkers from the counties and tribes having access in, as well as here we have other assisters like navigators who use the system to help people access health coverage. At this point, Madam Chair, I'm going to ask Ms. Radke from Dakota County to discuss the what I've just gone through from a county perspective and put a county give a county perspective on the older systems.
Thank you, Deputy Commissioner Johnson. Ms. Radke, if you can introduce yourself for the record and state your affiliation and welcome.
Thank you. Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee, and Mr. Johnson. My name is Stephanie Radke. I am Director of External Relations and Strategic Initiatives for Dakota County Community Services. And I am also a county representative on the DHS Enterprise Architecture Board, which provides governance for DHS IT projects. And I appreciate this opportunity to provide the county perspective on DHS IT systems in support of modernization. I would just begin my comments by sharing that thousands of county employees are really entirely dependent on DHS systems to deliver services locally in Minnesota's 87 counties, as well as the tribes. And without effective, robust systems at the state level, we are unable to effectively administer these programs to Minnesota residents. What is currently happening is that counties must often invest locally to make up for missing state functionality, given the age of our current legacy systems, as well as to account for local case management needs. Many of the DHS systems do not have enough functionality to account for case management at that local level. This currently results in duplication of effort across counties, as well as, you know, just across the system generally, certainly increased costs for the system as a whole, and often poor customer service. Consumers of our system, often in difficult circumstances when seeking out services, just as an example, must often repeat their story, provide information multiple times, just given the siloed nature of our current systems. We need updated systems in order to innovate within our system. And we're rapidly coming up against expectations, both from consumers of our services, as well as staff. County employees who deliver these services are really expecting 21st century level of expectations of customer service and what they're used to, you know, with other services, be it, you know, banking or, you know, online shopping, et cetera. You know, our current systems just really don't deliver that level of service. So just by way of examples, you know, currently with the pandemic, we've had to adapt to more virtual service delivery, and we anticipate that becoming, you know, much more the norm going forward. We have a lot more use of needing to use text messaging for communication, mobile devices. Many people we serve don't have, you know, big desktops or laptops. I mean, they're doing all of their business on their phones. And additionally, counties are finding it very effective to work more in a mobile setting within the community, actually leaving our offices and getting into the community. And our current systems do not support that very well. On a more macro level, I mean, we're seeing great opportunities and the need to really transform our human services delivery system. We know that people are rarely on one program. They are often on multiple programs and are interacting with multiple staff within counties, as well as community partners. It's not just county staff. And we know that our outcomes are impacted by our ability to offer, you know, much more person-centered and integrated service delivery that is culturally aware. So that ability to share data, to have people ask once, enter once, and how can we more effectively share data while guarding privacy concerns to improve case planning and service coordination. So those are just a few of the examples of some issues we're facing with service delivery and the lack of interoperability. Next slide, please.
Madam Chair, I wanted to step through a few of the things that we're doing as we move forward and working with county, tribal, and other partners as we do this. There are sort of three themes here, and I'll talk a little bit about each of them. The first is sustaining our legacy systems. We have to sustain the systems we have now. They are going to be our support for the time being as we're working toward replacing and modernizing them. And we have to manage that risk appropriately. Looking at improvements while we're planning. So we're planning for the future, we're planning for where we want to go, but we also can and do continue to make improvements as we're going along. And so you can go to the next slide. On sustainability, we can't have the system tip over. We can't have any of these systems tip over. We need to maintain this infrastructure in order to keep the system running. And so we've made it a priority to review sustainability, working with MNIT, and ensure that we have the adequate resources dedicated to this. It's a lot about people and documentation and basic maintenance. People I mentioned before, we have an aging, some of the people who work in these systems are at retirement point, and we need to make sure that we are doing knowledge transfer, doing succession planning, getting training for new people who may be coming in to work on what is older technology that may not, we may need to do the training where the training may not exist in other markets right now. Documenting so that we don't have people walking out the door with something in their head that nobody else knows how to do. And our documentation needs improvement on some of our older systems. So it's a project, as well as basic maintenance, outdated tools and codes that need to be updated. So that's one focus that we've made as we continue to move forward. We also are continuing to make improvements, and I'll just share a few examples here. These are a couple of exciting things that we've done over the last year, mobile-friendly tools that we've been working on to improve services. The first is MIN Benefits, which is an integrated benefits application. We've been working with counties and tribal nations and MNIT as well, but with Code for America on this. And they really use a human-centered design approach where they're spending a lot of time talking with the actual recipients who are using the app, talking a lot with county workers who are trying to process the cases that are coming through, and trying to learn and from an agile perspective, continuing to make improvements as we learn more going forward. And Hennepin and Olmsted counties are working in that pilot right now. But you can see the results. You have about 4,000 applications and 12 minutes sitting with your phone compared to having to go into the county and fill out a bunch of forms and meet with the worker is an amazing improvement in terms of a client service perspective. Similarly, we had an opportunity, jumped at an opportunity when the federal government moved forward last spring, I think, with an initiative to provide SNAP benefits to families who were losing essentially school lunch because kids weren't in school and families were having then difficulty stretching their dollars to be able to feed their children. And so there are benefits made available to families, but since these families weren't all already on SNAP or known to us at THS, we needed to find a way to reach out to them and to give them a way to reach in and apply and be able to get these benefits. And again, working with Code for America, we were able to put together a quick application and a texting service to run this system. And we're able to distribute, I believe it was over $60 million to the families who are not those already known to us through the SNAP program. And so again, there are opportunities here. The back-end systems will be what they'll be, but we can improve some of the front-end experience for people through initiatives like this. We also continue to do what is some of the harder work, which is we have systems that just need to be improved and updated as we go forward. METS is certainly an example. As you know, when METS was launched in 2013, there were many issues with it. There are still issues today that we'll continue to work on. We've been working on improving it over the course of the last 5 or 6 years, including the METS MMS interface renewals processing, which continues to be a pain point for counties, and reducing the duplicate ID creation. A number of initiatives that we keep moving forward in METS in order to try to improve the system as much as we can. And MMIS, the federal government is requiring all states to modernize their MMIS systems. They've set forward for quite a while now. We've had what's called MITA, Medicaid Information Technology Architecture, that they want states to work within. We've been working on that as well as creating a new provider screening portal for provider screening, which is built into our Medicaid program as part of the Affordable Care Act. as well as just some of the back-end stuff, critical server and software upgrades within MMIS to ensure that it remains stable. And then my avatar, I mentioned that this is the medical record for our direct care and treatment, which it is, but it has a lot of, we have a lot of work to do to get to being a full medical record. Right now we are still operating between paper and system. And we have, I met with staff sometime recently and they had a stack of like four boxes behind them. It was the file for one client, someone who'd been with us for a long time and longer term treatment and care. But a lot of that is still in paper. And a lot of the times when, particularly if we're transferring a client, it can be very hard to get together the records from the electronic side, from the paper side, and make sure we have everything that's needed to transfer someone if they're going to the hospital for a hospital stay or something like that. So we are working to free up resources internally, may come back and ask you at some point for resources to really move ourselves toward a fully compliant medical record for our direct care and treatment. Finally, I want to talk a little bit about planning and the planning we're doing. And Ms. Radke talked a little, mentioned this a little bit too, referenced it a little bit. We started, I think, about 4 years ago working with counties, a tribal partner, as well as our MINUT partners in developing what we call the integrated services business model. We really wanted to start with where do we want to be in a service delivery model before we started talking about what IT itself needed to look like, because the IT needs to support the model that we want, not vice versa. And so this was really getting toward a person-centered integrated model of delivering services. And integrated goes to, again, what I think Stephanie, Ms. Radke was saying, that a person has multiple needs. And the way our system often treats them now is they walk in through one door, and that's what we look at. We look at whatever that program is. We're looking at their economic assistance needs and not looking broadly at what are their housing needs, are their mental health, are there other needs for the children in the family that may or may not get treated. Different counties to handle these things differently. Some are progressing better than others. But we still, from a system standpoint, are set up very much in these silos. We want to break that down and move to a more person-centered way of delivering services. And as I said at the beginning, you know, no wrong door, ability from an IT perspective, people to interact with us in multiple ways, to own their own data, to be able to go and look at what their case file says, to not have to come get it from somebody, and to be able to use data to provide better services and to improve services and to improve our strategy on how we deliver services. So that was a framework that was developed a few years ago that we've been working off of since. A piece of this that I want to mention very explicitly is business readiness and doing the upfront work before we start building. I have had the honor of being on the Governor's Blue Ribbon Commission for Information Technology. Representative Bonner is also on the committee. And we talked a lot about this in the modernization subgroup that I was part of last year. Making sure that you are ready to move toward the new IT solution. You've done all this work on the business side first. So partnering, making sure that we're partnering with all the people who we interact with, providers, counties, tribes, community organizations, understanding the perspective of those who we serve. Simplifying program rules. We have so much complexity that is baked into these older systems that the systems are themselves inflexible. When you take the complexity of the policy together, it really makes it hard to make changes. I think we're proposing this year some changes to client reporting for MFIP and general assistance to try to streamline that, reduce some of the reporting requirements and align it with other programs so clients have similar reporting requirements across programs. Makes a lot of sense. It would simplify things, but it takes a really long time to do because you have to undo all the old complexity that's already in the system in order to rebuild the new simpler rules. And so we really need to be looking at how we can simplify rules. And developing technology solutions obviously support where we want to go. And looking at how we can take shorter implementation cycles, not the great big five-year project, but the quicker hits where we can make a difference and make improvements in a shorter time period. Another aspect of planning that I want to mention that's really critical for us right now is we determined about a year ago that we needed some independent help assessing where we are and where we're going with our IT future, and put out an RFP and have hired Gartner Inc. And Gartner is here now about two-fifths of the way, I believe, from the way they track it through this analysis. This is called a CIRM assessment because we focused it a lot on the CIRM product, which is the product that Metz is built on. It's an IBM product. And when we started with Metz in 2013 with this product, we were anticipating at the time CIRM was one of the few products in the market that really covered the breadth of human services, that we wanted to move toward using CIRM more broadly across human services. We're sort of reassessing that question now and asking Gartner to bring us forward a go-forward strategy that would provide options and incorporate the recommendations from that roadmap into how we go forward. We actually did this in 2011, and it was partly what led us towards some of the decisions we made that didn't work out so well when we made decisions with the Affordable Care Act and development of the Metz system. We obviously, a lot has changed since 2011, and we want to look at how we can be better prepared for those next steps. So, ignore the next slide. The roadmap go forward to provide a holistic enterprise level kind of future vision for where we're going from an IT perspective. And of course, assess the role of the IBM CIRM product, where it fits or doesn't fit, and try to figure out how we can minimize risks and optimize. What other software is out there? What other options? What other pathways are out there? What are other states doing? How do we leverage what works in our legacy systems without remaining wholly dependent on them for, you know, several more decades? Again, other states have used the legacy systems to great advantage going forward by building onto them rather than simply completely replacing them. That final report, I believe, is due this summer from CIRM. So we'll be in a better position next year to be talking about where we think we want to go from a system-wide perspective. And so again, having laid all that out, I want to give Ms. Radke an opportunity to speak from the county perspective on this go forward work.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. I think Mr. Johnson did a really nice job covering our goals around integrated service delivery and just much of the planning that we've jointly undertook the last few years. I would just add that, I mean, just in the last 10 years, I think there's been a lot of research, and it really is pointing to the need for this more integrated person-centered approach, and that it really does make a difference. You know, how we deliver these services makes a difference for outcomes for people, and how can we make better use of our resources in the system and curb some of the churn that we see with people entering and exiting, you know, many programs multiple times. A few key things that we need going forward is administrative simplification. And again, Mr. Johnson talked a little bit about the policy complexity that we currently have in our systems. And in addition to that policy, and specifically eligibility policy, I think counties for a long time have advocated on just the burden it places both on consumers of our services as well as staff. If we have just slightly varying degrees of eligibility policy for the same population, it just requires that many more hoops for us to jump through, that much more work for people who use our services. So how can we simplify that policy for its intended purposes as much as possible? I would also add under administrative simplification, simplified processes, and that's a big piece that we're looking at in this modernization work as well. And just a few examples of that include, how we manage the many documents that come through that we need to do our job. So verifications that people need to submit, like income stubs, wage stubs, tax forms, that kind of thing. How can we simplify those processes and make that easier, both for people we serve as well as for county staff? Currently, we spend a tremendous amount of time just managing those, more intensive paper processes. We also are very dependent in partnering with DHS to create that solid technology foundation. And, I think what we mean by that, just by way of, again, a few examples, is, 21st century best practices for integrating data and sharing data across what are now our very siloed systems. Again, we need our child support people to be able to talk to our income maintenance people and to be able to see that data, as well as with social services. Right now, it is incredibly hard just for people, by way of example, here in Dakota County, who may work on different floors in the same building, to obtain that information that they are legally entitled to under the Minnesota Government Data Practices Act. So how can we create those systems that will support that? That's part of that solid technology foundation, as well as the ability to share that data across our system. So not just within county, but counties increasingly rely on contracted partners and many service providers within our communities to serve our clients. So how can we better share that data, but also with appropriate data privacy protections? So we know, like with updated technology, there's a lot more we can do to ensure we have appropriate consents, that we have the right triggers, that we can share data appropriately, but also make sure we're guarding that data that needs to be protected. We also need to, as I mentioned earlier, do a better job of supporting interoperability across our systems. How can we make sure that our systems talk together? So, you know, anything we do at the counties, and hopefully we can minimize county investment. Right now, there's just a tremendous amount of duplication, but how can we better make our development going forward be able to interoperate, talk, share data, and be more intentional about that development going forward? And I would say lastly, that really depends on a continued and growing strong state-county partnership, and I would include tribes in there as well. We need to better understand how our various components of service delivery interact and be very intentional in how we're working together on our system development going forward. We can better leverage our collective resources if we do that, as we improve our technology. That is a key goal. And I would say lastly, that partnership is really going to be dependent on improved governance and how are we making our decisions going forward. And that is something that we have been spending a lot of time on together. And so not just including our system partners in these technology decisions, but also being really intentional with including the voice of consumer will be important going forward. Next slide, please.
Thank you, Ms. Radke and Deputy Commissioner Johnson. I really appreciate having the county's perspective as we talk about information technology and the systems. And I know it sounds like we're proposing some administrative simplification in some of our programs from what we're learning during this COVID crisis. So hopefully we can implement those to reduce that paperwork and reporting requirements. I have one question for Deputy Commissioner Johnson, and then we have two members with questions so far. I'm just wondering, are we setting aside money in a fund to improve and replace these legacy IT systems? Like, are we taking a certain percentage of overhead and doing that? And the second question is, do you foresee working with our federal partners in getting federal assistance for updating our IT systems, and are other states experiencing similar problems with their IT systems?
Madam Chair, thanks for the question. I wouldn't say that we had been setting money aside. There have been a couple of appropriations that have been made to the department for modernization. We've mostly used those on some of what I ran through in the slides, as well as some of the planning work that we've been doing. We are basically maintaining some of the going forward by just setting it aside within our existing budget, just trying to figure out how we manage within that budget to pull out enough to ensure that we can keep our planning work going and keep whatever kind of updates and upgrades we need going. And obviously, we've diverted a lot of resources to COVID that we're still going to have to understand the longer term impacts of that as we start to settle out of that. We're very interested in working with our federal partners. You might recall that there was a period when the federal government was providing 90% reimbursement on all development that had any inclusion of Medicaid. So we could get 90%, not just for the Medicaid work, which we can still get, but also for other work that was part of that larger project, as long as Medicaid was in it. Meaning if we were doing fixing something that benefited Medicaid, TANF, SNAP, we could get 90% reimbursement across all of that. That ended a couple of years ago. We were unsuccessful at getting the federal government to extend it at that time. I know there's interest in doing something like that again. We've expressed interest in having just more money coming to states, even in a direct fashion. A lot of states are struggling with how to keep this infrastructure afloat and modernize it. And I think it would be very beneficial. So I know we've been talking with, particularly with Representative McCollum in her office about putting together essentially a task force that would look at this issue for what states' needs are and what the federal response could be. We'll be really excited to see that opportunity come to fruition.
Thank you, Deputy Commissioner. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And my question also is for the Deputy Commissioner. Commissioner Johnson, in a number of your slides laid in your deck, we talk about improvements to the technology that support the systems that our citizens rely upon. I did not hear, though, and forgive me if it was included, any reference to a coordination with Minute. And in lieu of the numerous systems that this state relies upon and the desire to make them inclusive, but also adhere to the cybersecurity measures that become even more prevalent in this day's environment. I'm just wondering if I missed that, or I'm sure it wasn't intentional, but I just hope that you would speak to that coordination.
Deputy Commissioner Johnson?
Madam Chair and Representative Albright, yeah, that's probably on me to have not mentioned Minute more prominently. Minute's our close partner in all of this. We work together with Minute seamlessly across everything that we do. Our Enterprise Architecture Board is co-chaired by, co-chaired by me and Greg Paling, who's our Chief Business Technology Officer from Minute. And we both sort of allowed others to step in now, but we have that shared responsibility and are constantly working with them. And that also includes not just the work we do on our applications and improvement, but the work that Minute Central does, as you mentioned, around security in particular, and working with them on a regular basis to ensure that we are keeping up with all the things that we need to do from a security standpoint to ensure that that information remains secure. So yes, that's probably on me to have not mentioned Minute more prominently. We actually were going to have Minute in the presentation. We decided it might be too much back and forth, so we decided not to, but we work with Minute very closely.
Thank you, Deputy Johnson. And we do have someone from Minute here if there are questions that are specific to Minute, Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, thank you. And for the Deputy Commissioner again, in light of the upgrades that are necessary, obviously there's a monetary attachment to each one of those. And I'm wondering if, and I don't recall seeing those in the governor's budget, I'm just wondering if that will be presented to this committee and your follow-on as we understand more about the forecasted revenues from the state, or will you be coming back with a more specific, granular budget in terms of which these items might cost and the a la carte menu, if you will, of priority?
Deputy Commissioner Johnson?
Madam Chair and Representative Albright, we did not bring forward a proposal this year. That's in part because I mentioned the assessment that Gartner is doing for us, feeling like we really wanted to have that done so that could come to you with a clear plan of what we were doing and how we were going to do it, rather than just we need a bunch of money to keep doing some good stuff. And so that's kind of where we felt like we're at. I think the one potential area where we could do more investment but have not brought forward at this point is direct care and treatment with electronic medical record. We obviously have a big ask on the table already for direct care and treatment, and we're focused there right now in order to keep them functioning and keep ourselves fully staffed.
Thank you. Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. And of course, thank you, Deputy Commissioner, for being here. Thank you also for doing an excellent job in your presentation of bringing that people-centered view right to the front. I know that you and Ms. Radke did a fantastic job on that. And I'll try to be brief because I know we're running short on time and limit my questions, but and not geek out too much. As you know, I have worked in technology for over 20 years, and this discussion makes me really excited because while a lot of people would make their eyes glaze over, the reality is that technology has the ability to improve lives for real people, to make government work for real people. And that's what I find really exciting about that. And certainly we understand that things are a work in progress. You alluded a little bit to, and so I'll start with one very specific question and then one more, hopefully we have time for one more. That is, you spoke a lot about the claims database and you spoke about the technology, and this was common in other areas too, by the way. You mentioned the use of mainframe technology and COBOL in sort of that architecture. We know that a lot of these systems are about 30 years old. A lot of folks on this call and a lot of legislators are probably not real familiar with what mainframe or COBOL are or what that means. And so I'm just hoping that you could maybe give us a little bit of context about the current technology infrastructure in those types of technologies. And as we talk about modernization of our systems and processing, how do these tools, right, the mainframe, the COBOL, those kinds of things, compare with some of the more modern techniques and technologies? And what potential gains would we have by moving away from some of those technologies that maybe aren't as used or have as much expertise anymore into something a little bit more modern?
Deputy Commissioner Johnson, if you want to take this or maybe defer to Mr. Ganatra, it's up to you.
Yes, Madam Chair, I'd actually like to ask Chaitin Granata, who's our Deputy Chief Business Technology Officer, to take this. I would just say, by way of introduction, I think that, you know, part of, like you said, Representative Bonner, like if you go onto Maxis and try to do work, you're looking at a green screen, which a lot of people don't know what green screen means anymore. Some of us are old enough to remember green screen and remember DOS and remember, you know, those early video games like the. So that's what it's like. And it's very challenging to work in. You have to know a bunch of codes. You have to plug all the codes into the right place to get you to the right next screen. And it's a very complicated way of doing business that's not in any way intuitive. So as Ms. Radke would tell you, it's a lot of training of county workers to help them understand what this thing is that they're looking at. But I'll ask Chaitin Ganatra.
Mr. Ganatra, can you introduce yourself to the committee?
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. Thank you, Deputy Commissioner Johnson. I'm Chaitin Ganatra. I'm the Deputy Chief Business Technology Officer for MINET supporting DHS and Minsure. And that's a very interesting question. How I would put it is, Deputy Commissioner Johnson said earlier, mainframe is a very stable system and can actually handle very large volumes of data and transactions. This system has been in existence for more than 30, 40 years, and of course it has evolved. But going back to the specific question, one thing that we do see a difference between mainframe systems and the newer technology is that the newer technology is built mostly on an object-oriented programming kind of idea, which is more modular. So it is much more agile to change. You can react to change much faster. With mainframe technologies, we also sometimes face issue of getting the right skill sets because it is an older technology and people are the new people coming into the IT industry are also more leaning towards the newer technologies. They all want to be in the newer technologies. So getting the right kind of skill sets can also be challenged sometimes. But the biggest difference I see is the agility that the newer systems or the newer technologies provide, which sometimes with mainframe systems is not available. And not purely because of technology, sometimes it's also these systems have been built over 30, 40 years and we have added stuff to it. And there is a little more, I actually started my career coding in mainframe systems. So Things have probably progressed a little where you can make it more modular, but the systems that have been developed over 30, 40 years are more streamlined and flow-through kind of systems. So that is the main difference I see between the modern technology systems and mainframe systems.
Thank you for that comment. I hate to cut off this interesting discussion of IT. I know Representative Bonner has more questions, and as does Representative Albright, but hopefully we can continue these discussions later this session about IT, and especially when we get that report this summer, we can continue those discussions. I thank everybody for their time. I'm going to adjourn the committee, and we're going to hear two bills tomorrow, so I'll look forward to seeing everyone tomorrow. And we are adjourned. Thank you.